What I'm going to talk today, which is homogenization of fully nonlinear equations in random media, is joint work with Taki Souganidis and Li Hai Wang. And let me tell you more or less what I plan to do. Let me just say first a few words, although many of you may know a lot about it, but just a few words about what is the problem, at least for a pure mathematician, what is the problematic of homogenization. Then I'd like to discuss a little bit with you what are fully nonlinear equations. In other words, what are the issues in fully nonlinear equations, the regularity theory, the main properties I will need. Then I will discuss how does the random media enters into studying fully nonlinear equations, and then why do we indeed have a homogenization limit. So the issues of homogenization arises in several contexts, from very pure to very applied mathematics. In material science, for instance, when you study effective properties of composite materials, and also in dynamical systems, a series of four problems of mainly started with Morse, and then Moser worked a lot in the 80s about how to foliate varieties with minimal surfaces, for instance. Okay. So homogenization is, in some sense, an attempt to link two scales. For instance, it could be that you are working a very small and medium-sized scale, so a spatial scale, or it could also be a temporal scale. For instance, if I drop a bucket of water in this rack, right, the water will accommodate and the water will diffuse in some, I won't do it, but, yeah. But it will diffuse in some way and will form some sort of big stain that, except for the wiggle at the edge of the drop, will more or less have a nice, maybe convex shape. But this convex shape will not be a circle, because although the rag appears from far away homogeneous, the microstructure says that the diffusion will occur at different speeds in different directions. Okay, so you want to, in some sense, be able to deduce this general shape of the big water stain from local considerations. In other words, to decide from local considerations what will that shape be. Another example is if I have a periodic, let's say, hilly terrain, right? In other words, I have a topography that is composed all of little hills, exactly one like the other, and I want to travel along these hills, then locally my geodesics will be a very wiggly thing. But now if I look at very long distances, in other words, in another way, let me assume that now that my periodic media is very, very, very small, and I try to travel from this point into different directions, then although I wiggle, the distance to the origin will look almost like a cone still, you know, because we'd be almost translation invariant. If I translate the initial and ending point, the error I can make in my distance is at least of one cell. So what I will get is a very wiggly cone, and this is the whole problem of Morse, the problem of studying geodesics in the torus in a periodic medium. So I will get a cone which sort of, this is distance to the origin, and sort of wiggles a little bit, but if I make my medium thinner and thinner, I will end up with a translation invariant distance, will be a real norm, and therefore the distance to the origin will be a real convex cone. No. I'm not talking light. I'm just talking take two points and join the geodesics. Okay, so we are not. Okay, well, you still will get a cone. The issue is the cone will be of a very, can be of a very funny shape. Okay? In other words, you still can homogenize distance, right? You still can talk about the geodesics, but the limiting cone will not be a circular cone. Okay? And in 3D, it's much more complex. In fact, almost nobody knows what the effective distance, I don't think there are basically explicit examples of what the effective distance is in a medium with very moderate hills. Okay? Or the distance will be barely C1 and rational directions, and there are a series of theorems that says basically that the effective distance function most probably will be very bad. Okay? So, one could assume, for instance, that the medium, instead of being perfectly periodic, as I said before, has some random organization. In other words, I suppose that I have these hills, and the hills are not all the same, right? But sort of the shape and the high and the slopes sort of repeat in some way statistically. In other words, the medium is random, but the statistics repeat themselves, okay? So still, if I start to walk among these random hills, if I go a short distance, things would be very funny. But if I want to go from here to 10,000 miles away around this distance, then in some sense, I will have an average speed. In other words, there will be some average speed with which I move. That will be the same for 1,000 miles and then for 5,000 miles. Okay? So in some sense, one still should expect some homogenization. Homogenization means that I should be able to link this local random scale to some global quantity. You know, I could say at long distances what happened. Okay? And similarly, a wall is really not periodic. If you look at the wall from very nearby, it's a granular array, it's a random arrangement, but in some sense the wall repeats itself. It is the arrangement that you see here or there more or less is the same, and therefore you expect to have effective constants. That is how heat or fluids or whatever diffuse along the wall will be at some, if you are interested in more or less medium-sized quantity, will be determined by some effective constants, okay? And this is what you want to see, if there are some effective constants. Now, you know, if you take about, more or less simple phenomena like this, and it is clear that such an effective constant exists and so on, if you go to much more nonlinear phenomena, then more degenerate, etc., then the issues become much more delicate. And it is not always trivial that you indeed have a homogenization limit. Okay? And this is what I want to discuss today, in a particular case, the case of fully nonlinear equations. So what I want to show is that you take a fully nonlinear equation, second-order equation, you in a random media with the standard properties, you ask for the random media to some sense have some global behavior, then there is a homogenization limit. Okay? So let me try to explain what fully nonlinear equations are about. Okay. So I want to make the distinctions between fully nonlinear equations and sort of divergence nonlinear equations, that the ones that come from the theory of a calculus of variations, because they have different, very different origin, very different structure, and the problematic is, in some sense, very different. Okay. So let me say that, you know, we all know the Laplace equation, right, the real part of an analytic function. And when you look at the simple applications of a Laplace equation, usually there are two ways in which it comes. You know, one is what we call the conservation law, the fluids or material application of Laplace equation, which is you, for instance, have a vector field, right, which would be a incompressible rotational flow or a conservative vector field, right? So you are given a vector field and you say it's incompressible, divergence zero, it's irrotational, curl zero, so it is the divergence of the gradient of a potential and you have Laplace equation. Okay? So if you follow that direction, what you get is the divergence theory of nonlinear equations. In other words, let me just say two words, right? You get the, so if you follow that approach and you say, okay, what is the general nonlinear problematic that will interest me, then you realize that what you want to look at is you want to study divergence of vector fields have J of gradient U prescribed. Okay, so a standard example is when you're looking at convex functions in the calculus of variations, that is, I want to minimize function as J of the form integral of capital F of gradient U, right? And if you take a local minimizer of such equation, that satisfies the Euler equation, divergence of Fj gradient U equal to 0. Okay? Now, divergence theory is the theory of these equations is basically geared towards the weak formulation. In other words, you think of a solution of this equation by multiplying by a function, integrating by parts, right? So to say this is the same as saying gradient eta Fj equal to 0. And so there is a whole, I will not enter into details, but there is a whole function analytic approach where you study H1 or whatever W1 P spaces, you minimize. If you want to think about homogenization, you really think of sequence of functionals and what is the limit of a sequence of facilitatory functionals and so on. So this is one type of problematic. Okay? But another application, another way in which Laplacian appears, for instance, is when you look at the random walk and many probabilistic applications, right? Where you said, okay, I flip a coin, or I flip two coins, and I decide if I'm going to move one to the right, one to the left, one in front, one back. Okay, and if you try to do a continuous theory out of it, you end up with a finite difference that relates your position now with the positions a further step away in the next time. Okay, so if you do that, so usually when you study random walk problems in probability, you end up with a different type, you end up with a non-divergence structure. In other words, you want to then study sort of the linear theory that you want to study. The linear theory that you want to study doesn't have any more the structure bi, aij, dj of u equal to 0, let's say, it has the structure Aij, let's say, this would be the linear theory, right, Aij, dij of u equal to 0. Okay? And sort of this apparently minimal difference between one equation and the other, which is passing that derivative through, makes completely two different theories. Okay. Okay, so let me try to then discuss for you what is a fully nonlinear equation that appears, for instance, in optimal control and problems like that in this context. Okay. So for instance, probably the simplest example you can think about the fully nonlinear equation is the following. I give you two operators, uxx plus uyy, and 2uxx plus 1/2 uiy. Okay? And I tell you, okay, I give you a domain omega, I give you these two simple operators, and I split the domain, I tell you, okay, you are allowed to split the domain any way you want, and put in each domain the operator you prefer. Okay? So I give you a domain like this, and I let you split it, and I say, okay, you want to solve, I let you solve an equation, L of u equal to minus 1, let's say, right? Where you choose your L of u in any piece you want. In some pieces you can put the Laplacian, in some others you can put L2. Okay? And I ask you, how large can the u get? Can it get very high? Can it be not too high? What can you tell me about the highest you can go with that u by arranging the operator? So it's sort of an optimization problem. Okay? And then the answer is, in order to do that, I have to solve this equation, maximum of Laplacian and 1/2 uxx, 2uxx plus 1/2 uyy equal minus 1. Okay. Sounds like a funny equation, but if I manage to solve this equation, right? Now, if I manage to find a sine function u that satisfies this equation, this will be a super solution for any choice you make. Okay, because no matter if you put in a piece one operator or the other, right, my function will be a super solution of that, because always both L1 and L2 are less than minus 1. Okay, so this is a super solution of all the things you can cook up, right? And it's a solution itself, because once I construct it, I have some domain where I put one operator and some other domain where I put the other. Okay? So the solution of this problem is an envelope for all possible solutions. Okay? And so it's used, for instance, it will be some sort of interval of confidence. You know, if you don't know what your diffusion is at every point, but you know that your diffusion is one or the other, then you know that the highest you can be is the solution of this equation. Okay? Yeah, you have the choice. And no matter how hard you try, you are not going to beat my solution. Okay? The partition is not given. You can take any possible partition, in other words, you can solve. So, this is sort of a simple example, and maybe a slightly more interesting one is what is called Pucci's extremal operators, which is the following. I take d square of u, right? And I take the Hessian of u, d square of u, has n eigenvalues, it's a symmetric matrix, lambda 1, lambda n. If I sum the eigenvalues, I get the Laplacian, right? Now suppose, let me take an example in 2D. Suppose instead of taking lambda 1 plus lambda 2, I ask you to solve the equation 2 lambda max, the largest of both eigenvalues, plus lambda mean. So 2D, you take the square of u, you take, has a largest eigenvalue and a smallest eigenvalue, the largest, I want twice the largest plus once the smallest equal to 0. Okay? I say that this is a lower envelope for all elliptic solutions of all elliptic equations whose ellipticity is between 1 and 2. In other words, you give me any solution of any equation, aij, dij of u equal to 0, with given data, where aij is between the identity and 2 times the identity, then all those solutions will be enveloped by below by this equation and by above by the other one. Okay. So again, this is sort of an interval of confidence that tells you if you all you know about your diffusion is the ellipticity constant, the worst that can happen one way or the other is the solution of these extremal operators. So elliptic equations, these extremal operators were known for a long time, you know, but it was not clear how could you find a solution of such an equation. You know, it's a relatively simple one, right, but extremely nonlinear. Tell you, take a function, take the Hessian, compute the eigenvalues, multiply the positive ones by 3, the negative ones by 2, add them up, you have to get 0. Okay? So I think the difficulty that blocked the understanding of fully nonlinear equations for many years was the lack of a flexible enough concept of solution, okay, that will give you enough compactness in the same way in which the Dirichlet principle works for divergence form nonlinear equations. Okay, divergence form, you want to solve the minimal surface equation. Instead of looking at the equation, you do look at surfaces that minimize the area integral, okay? And this was a very flexible method of treating weak solutions. In fact, if you look historically, there first was an attempt to understand equations like these, equations of this form, and if aij, we are close to the Laplacian, in other words, if aij, we are regular, Then there was the Schauder theory of second-order elliptic equations, the Calderon-Sigmund theory, and so on. Okay, and people understood, if you look at the very early papers of minimal surface theory, they tried to understand the minimal surface by its non-divergence structure. Okay, but it was only when the Giorgi, proved his theorem, then there was the Giorgi-Nash-Moser theory, where they proved that solutions of equations of this with these structures were sort of universally regular, that is the Harnack inequality, then sort of things shifted and people study extensively nonlinear equations in divergence form because they have this powerful tool, they have this way of treating them under a much simpler functional situation and so on. So about 20 years ago, I would say, the theory of fully nonlinear equations really developed due to two important developments. One was the Kirilov-Safonov-Harnack inequality, sort of the equivalent of the Giorgi theorem for the calculus of variation, that says that if you take any solution of an equation like this, with coefficients which are only measurable, which is there is no regularity in the coefficient, then such a solution is Helder continuous. Okay? Notice that to say that I have a solution of an equation like this, where I do not only assume that this is an elliptic matrix, a positive definite matrix, you can think it geometrically in a very nice fashion. You are saying, right, what does it mean that I give you an equation like this, where I'm not saying anything about these coefficients, just that it's an elliptic matrix. What I'm telling you is that the positive second derivatives are in some sense balanced by the negative second derivatives. In some sense that the positive eigenvalues are comparable to the negative eigenvalues. Okay? So it's like having a surface of which all the information you have is that the largest positive curvature is in some sense not too much larger than the largest negative one. So it's a balance of the way the surface curves up or down, which is in some sense, again, this idea of extrema. Okay. The other important development was the idea of Crandall-Lyons of looking at weak solutions of fully nonlinear equations in a way that really replaced the Dirichlet principle, in some sense, the integration by parts. So, pardon? Okay, I'm already at this. Next time I'll. Okay. Okay. So to try to understand what is the idea of viscosity or Crandall-Lyons solutions of elliptic equations. Let me say, so, at a difference with a divergence equation where you have never seen a solution, because you take a divergence equation and I ask you, write me one solution, right? It's impossible that you write one in general if the coefficients are not smooth. Because you take a quadratic polynomial, doesn't work. Take any polynomial doesn't work because the divergence involves the coefficient and the function. If I tell me, write me a solution of an equation like this, well, you take a quadratic polynomial, right? And the square of a quadratic polynomial is a constant. So it falls on this surface or not. In other words, f of the square of u, right, is defining in some sense a surface in the d square space, right? If I tell you, write me a solution of 2 lambda 1 plus lambda 2 equal to 0, you tell me, well, x1 square minus 1 half x2 square, right? Or whatever variations you want. You can write many solutions, many subsolutions, and so on. So in some sense, the idea is that if you have an equation in this form, right, in some sense it's determined by which quadratic polynomials are a solution of the equation. In other words, to give you the function f of the square of u is the same as if I list for you all possible quadratic polynomials that lie on the surface. Okay? And although this seems to be a simple idea, it's a I want you to keep it in mind because I will sort of use it later. Okay. So let me add one extra hypothesis to F. Let me add that F is monotone as a function of d squared of u. In other words, suppose that the F I give you, if I add to my matrix a positive matrix, I get something larger. Okay? So if F is monotone as a function of u, right, this is what basically says that the operator is elliptic, then I make the following observation. So suppose I have a very nice C2 solution of f of d squared of u equal to 0. And I manage to construct some polynomial that touches u by below. Then its quadratic part is smaller, right? And therefore, f of d squared of p has to be negative, because f is monotone. So if I have any polynomial that touches u by below, f of the square of p has to be negative. Okay? So for instance, if I have that u is harmonic, any polynomial that touches u by below has to be superharmonic. Any polynomial that touches u by above has to be harmonic. So the idea of Crandall and Lyons is very simple. It says, okay, we will say that the function u satisfies the equation if I can only touch it by below by polynomials that are supersolutions, and by above by polynomials that are subsolutions. So for instance, I want to tell you, suppose I have a continuous function, and I want to tell you that this continuous function satisfies uxx equal to 0. Okay? But I'm not allowed to integrate by parts anymore, right? So what I tell you is, okay, I'm going to say that uxx is equal to 0 if I have here the graph of u, the only way I can touch u by below is by concave polynomials, and the only way I can touch it by above is by convex polynomials. Okay? So if whenever I have a polynomial that touches my graph by below, it's concave, and whenever I can touch it by above, it's convex. Okay? So simple theorem, u is linear. Okay? Because u is not linear, then I can always find a polynomial that will touch it by above. It is not convex, or a polynomial that touches by below and is not concave. Okay? So this is a notion, in principle, a notion of each solution that you can apply to any f of the square of u, as long as it is elliptic, as long as it's monotone on the square. Or the square of u, d of u and x, right? All you have to do is to say, if I touch it by below by a polynomial, then this quantity has to be negative. Okay. So notice that this is a very weak requirement of u, right? I'm not asking, all I'm asking for u is that if I touch it with a polynomial at some point, the polynomial has to have the right sign. So if u is so chaotic that I cannot touch it in many points, right, that's okay. I'm not, you know, only at those points which are nice enough, I am required something, okay? So you can say, okay, this is a cute definition, but maybe it doesn't take you anywhere, right? Because the value of a definition is as good as how far it takes you. And this, maybe you can construct a function which basically you can only touch it with a polynomial at rational points. So, you know, what does it mean? Now, the powerful of this sort of apparently naive definition is that under very reasonable hypothesis, if you have a function that is a solution in this extremely weak sense, then indeed it's a classical solution. If f is convex in the square of u and it's a uniform elliptic, then the function that at the beginning was this continuous function that you knew what happens when you touch it with a polynomial. All of a sudden, it's a classical solution. The second derivatives are defined everywhere, and the equation is satisfied point-wise. Okay? If you add to this the enormous compactness that Krylov-Safonov-Harnack inequality applies to these weak solutions, and so if you add to this the enormous compactness that Krylov-Safonov definition gives to the equation, then it becomes really a very, very powerful tool. Okay. So much for second-order fully nonlinear equations. Let me now sort of try to describe what is in the context that I want to discuss of these equations on random media. Okay? So in some sense, what I want to discuss now is the following. I have this example of perfectly periodic media, where I hope that equations will have some sort of homogenization limit when I shrink my media smaller and smaller, right? And then I said, okay, suppose my media is not exactly periodic, right? It's organized in a random fashion, but in some sense repeat itself. Then what does it mean, this repeating itself? Okay? And I want to address now sort of what does it mean to have a random media for which you expect a homogeneous limit. Okay? And so let me take sort of to Stig's idea a simple example. Okay? So suppose I just as before, I take two operators. There's one left here. Suppose I take, as before, two simple operators, uxx plus uyy, and one-half uxx plus 2uyy. Okay? And I take a plane and split it in cubes of size 1, okay, and on squares of size 1. Okay? And I flip a coin. And in each cube, I put a 1 or a 0. Okay? So I call this L0, I call this L1, and I build an operator in the whole plane just by putting in each square L1 or L0. Okay? So for each configuration, that is, for each time I flip the coins for all of a space, I'm going to call this a configuration omega, right? Okay, so for each configuration, for each array of zeros and one, I have one operator, which I build in these simple fashions, just by putting L0, L0, L1, L1, L0, and so on. So let me call this L sub omega. Okay? So, for instance, in this simple example, at large scales, right, at large scale, we expect that most configurations, zeros and one, will entangle in such a fashion that you will have a limit, that solutions of these equations, right, will, in some sense, become in the limit solutions of an equation which is translation invariant, okay? In other words, let me write, you can think, you see, in homogenization, you can think sort of Liouville problems at infinity. In other words, what happens with the solution of this problem? What is the behavior at infinity, a solution of this problem? Or you can scale your medium and think what happens locally to the limiting equation. Okay? So, in some sense, what we have there, right, if we scale the medium, is the following. We are looking at a sequence as solutions of equations of the form f of d squared of u, x over epsilon, right? That is like taking your one-size medium and rescaling into an epsilon-size medium, right? The effect of the x over epsilon has the property of shrinking your medium, right? And you ask, for each configuration omega, you have a solution in this domain of this equation, right? And you ask, when epsilon goes to 0, do I expect for almost every omega, for almost every configuration, to have that this converges to the solution of a single equation, f of d squared of u, now translation invariant and omega independent. Okay? So this is the issue of finding an homogenization limit, to show that indeed, right, sort of, when the configurations shrink more and more, the zeros and the one, right, sort of mix in such a fashion that at the end, you will have almost surely a unique solution of a single translation invariant equation. Okay? I'm going to show that if you have, for instance, if you fix any boundary condition, then the sequence will converge almost surely to a single solution of the same equation with the same boundary condition. Pardon? Independent of the boundary condition. It's a local issue. It's sort of like finding the equivalent of the local corrector. Okay? Yeah. Pardon? In the periodic case, if this were a linear equation, Aij of x, then the matrix will end up being a constant matrix. In general, if it's a fully nonlinear equation, what you end up is with a limiting fully nonlinear equation, right? Which is translation invariant, has the same properties as the F. For instance, if the Fs have all the same fixed ellipticity constants, the limit F star has the same ellipticity constants. One important property is that if the Fs are convex or concave, the limit is convex or concave, which is a very important particular case in optimization. Okay? No. The local elliptic equation, this is the advantage of ellipticity, I guess, the limit is less the same as in divergence homogenization. You know, the energy functional converges to a single limit, no matter the boundary conditions you put. And here is the same. You get uniformly elliptic F, you get a limiting equation, and the solutions converge to this solution of a limiting equation. Let me point out that, in fact, there's an aside of this, that this is a consequence of the Crandall-Lyons viscosity method and the compactness, because, in fact, what I'm going to show you is just that, sort of, if I put quadratic polynomial data, I end up with some very particular quadratic polynomials. And then that characterizes completely the homogenization limit, because of the compactness of sequence and the Crandall-Lyon theory that says to know the equation, all I have to know is which polynomials are subsolutions and supersolutions. Okay? Okay. So basically, you know, I just think on this setting, but the theorem, we prove the theorem is in a standard setting that says, that comes from ergodic theory, that says that you have this the probability space, which in our example is the space of all configurations W, and you have the integer translations that act on the probability space. In our case, all you do is just translate the whole configuration, right? If you give me a vector X, I can take my array of zeros and ones and just translate them as a whole, so the integer vectors act on this configuration. The translation is measure preserving, that is, you take a bunch of configurations and you translate them, the probability is the same of this configuration as these configurations, and the other extra thing is that I will ask that the ergodic, that is, that the only family configurations that are form invariant sets under the translations have or measure 0 or measure 1. Okay? So, but as I, for illustration in this lecture, just think always on this space, simple example of independent random variables. Okay, and what I need then to show that indeed homogenization happens, that indeed you have a limit, is an ergodic theorem that basically says the following, says that for each, suppose that for each configuration and each domain in Rn, right? So in our case we have these configurations, I take a domain in Rn. So suppose I have a set function that is, let's say, non-negative, bounded by Lebesgue measure, okay, and it's of additive. That is the sum, you take a family of disjoint cubes, the sum of the measure of the cubes is bigger than the measure of D, and also that is invariant under the action, right? The relation of this quantity with the ergodic action is that if you translate that, doesn't translate the configuration, translate the domain, this measure should be the same, okay? So then the theorem says that if this is the case, then as the size of, you fix the configuration, for instance, you take larger and larger balls centered at the origin, right? Then this, the ratio between h of b and the measure of b goes almost surely to some quantity which is independent of the configuration, okay? So this is a classical theorem, and this is what I'm going to use. It's basically the tool I need. Sort of in some sense, I like to think on this theorem as saying, okay, this says that the medium is organized well enough that you should expect in the limit to have a homogenization limit. So for instance, a trivial example of H would be just to consider in these configurations the proportion of ones that you have to the whole square. In other words, in principle, for every configuration, you have many, little, almost one, almost zero, but what you expect in the limit is this will be a subadditive, an additive quantity, and what you expect, of course, is to have one half in the limit. Okay? Okay. So now let me try. So now I would like to sort of discuss what is the homogenization process. Okay? In other words, now I have a function f of the square of u and x and omega. That is, I'm giving you this elliptic equation for each configuration omega, as I did before, right? For each configuration omega, I have a different elliptic equation, right? The function f is, this is capital F, is strictly monotone. That means ellipticity, okay? And is that uniformly in some way in x and omega. And I want to then convince you that, for instance, if we fix a domain and we solve this equation, then as epsilon goes to zero, the solution will converge almost surely to a single function solution of this unique translation invariant equation. Okay? And I won't go through the details, but in some sense, using the Crandall-Lyons approach, then all I need to know is sort of what happens with quadratic polynomials. In other words, what are the quadratic polynomials which are, in some sense, solutions or subsolutions. In other words, let me rephrase it. I want to find this F star, okay? And I'm going to use the philosophy I said before. To define this function F star, right, all I need to do is to list for you which polynomials are going to be a super solution of F star, and which polynomials are going to be a subsolution of F star. And if I manage to do that, then by this this idea of viscosity solutions of Crandall-Lyons and the compactness in the problem, then I basically can prove that any sequence of sort of solutions to these problems, any family of solutions of these problems that converge to something, have to converge to a solution of this equation. Notice that although I don't know anything about F star, I know a lot, because I know by Crandall-Lyons theory that any very weak solution of this equation, if, for instance, F star is convex and uniformly elliptic, is going to be C to alpha. So I will know that limiting solutions are really very nice. Pardon? Yeah, W was my random variable, yes. No, it's independent. I have the random variables, and then I do the scaling in x in epsilon. Okay? So I just, it's like shrinking the space, right? In the case of before, I had the configuration, I shrink it. Okay? yeah, in other words, I take the copy of the space and I'm shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. Okay? Okay. Okay, so. No, even in 2D geodesics, in general, you cannot say what F star is. No. No, you mean like correctors in the. No, no. And most of nonlinear problems, usually, you, as I said, 2D geodesics, nobody knows what is the effective distance. Okay, so let me try to explain you how do we construct the homogenization limit. Okay, and for that, I'm going to use a tool from problems, elliptic problems with constraints. Okay, so I want to discuss for a few minutes what is the obstacle problem. Okay. Okay. So the obstacle problem is the following. Sometimes it's referred in the literature as the membrane problem and so on. Suppose I solve an elliptic equation. Say Laplacian of u equal to 1, let's say, I put data here and will give me some surface like this. Okay? This corresponds to a membrane that you are pushing down with constant pressure. Okay? Now suppose I said, no, but now I have this membrane, but I will not let it go through this plane. In other words, I push the membrane down, but then the membrane gets stuck in the plane. That's called the obstacle problem, okay, and it can be characterized, the solution then will be something like this, will stick horizontally to the plane and come out again like this, right, and it's characterized as being the least supersolution of the equation above the plane. Okay, so the solution to the obstacle problem, I give you a general equation, okay, and I said, let's take the least supersolution of this problem that sticks, stays above this constraint, okay, that's the solution of the obstacle problem, and has three important properties. The first one is, okay, so now I'm going to solve what I'm going to show you in a minute is the following. I'm going to take a quadratic polynomial, right? I'm going to take my equation, f d square of u, x omega, okay? And I'm going to put same boundary data as the quadratic polynomial, okay? So I'm going to take quadratic polynomial p0, I'm going to solve this, and I'm going to put same boundary data. And in general, my solution will wiggle around that polynomial and may be far away from it. Okay. Okay. So the idea is the following. If I take a polynomial which is very concave, right, like a large multiple of x squared, then for sure my solution will be above. Okay. If I lift my polynomial for a while, will be a while, at some moment the solution is going to attempt to cross the polynomial. At that point, instead of solving the free problem, I'm going to solve the obstacle problem. In other words, as this polynomial goes up, instead of letting my solution go through, right, I'm going to take the least supersolution of this problem above this polynomial. So it's going to be something like this. It's going to stick here. It's going to go up. It's going to stick here again, and so on. Okay, so in other words, I'm going to drag the solution up with the polynomial in this particular choice, the obstacle problem. Okay. So let me list three important properties of the solution. The first one is that the way in which the solution separates from the obstacle is with a totally universal speed. In other words, you can show that if the solution touches the obstacle at a point, and you take a ball of radius r, the solution grows quadratically away. It cannot come and touch like this. Grows quadratically away in a totally universal fashion, depending only on the ellipticity of the operator. Okay. So the solution, when it touches, sort of sticks close to the obstacle for a while. Quadratic separation. Pardon? Pardon? No, it may stick or not, but doesn't separate with at most quadratic speed. That is, this difference, the thing stays below some quadratic polynomial. That is, the difference grows quadratically at a totally universal rate. Yes, yeah. But important is the C11 estimate. U minus the obstacle minus P is at, in a neighborhood of x0 is less than a universal constant x minus x0 squared. Okay? This constant depends only on ellipticity and the polynomial. Okay? The second property is that the size of the contact set controls the distance to the real solution. So let's call this U obstacle, and we have the real solution U, the unconstrained solution. Then U minus U0 is controlled by the measure of the contact set. The unconstrained solution. The unconstrained solution. In other words, if the set where the constrained solution touches is very small, that means that the unconstrained solution cannot be too far down. Okay, they are close to each other. And the third important property is that this contact set is monotone on the domain. In other words, if I have my polynomial and I solve in this domain, this is the least super solution, right? So now suppose I take a smaller domain and I try to solve here. This is an admissible super solution. So the least super solution is strictly below this. So the contact set is bigger for the smaller domain than for the larger domain. Okay. Now what I'm going to do is the following. It says, give me a quadratic polynomial, and I'm going to tell you if the polynomial you give me is a sub or a super solution of the limiting equation. Okay? So you give me a quadratic polynomial P0, right? And I have to tell you if x star of d square of P0 is bigger or equal than 0 or smaller or equal than 0. No, this will define f star. This was the philosophy I said before. To define an f star, all I have to do is to list for you all of those quadratic polynomials for which f star is less or equal than 0 or bigger or equal than 0. Okay. So for that, my quantity h from the ergodic theorem, the subadditive or superadditive quantity, is going to be the measure of the contact set. In other words, I'm going to get P0, and I'm going to solve, I'm going to take any cube Q, right? Take any configuration omega, right? And I'm going to solve, so this is P0, I'm going to solve the function U obstacle, right, corresponding to this P0. This P0 in the cube Q for the configuration omega. Okay. So I'm going to solve the obstacle problem for F of the square of U X omega in the cube Q0. Okay. So I'm going to solve that. It's something like this. I'm going to look at the measure of the contact set. No, P0, you gave me a polynomial. Yeah, it's going to act as an obstacle. Right, right, you're right. You gave me P0, take a cube, take P0, it acts as my obstacle, I solve the equation, and I look at the measure of the contact set. I'm going to call this H of Q. This is, as I said before, by the monotonicity of the obstacle problem, right, this is superadditive, that is the measure of the large cube is less than the sum of a measure of any decomposition by cubes. Because if I make any decomposition by cubes, the measure of the obstacle set in each cube is bigger than the other one. So H is superadditive. And so for the P0 you gave me, H has a limit, an almost sure limit. Converges to has an ergodic limit HP0. Okay. Now I say two things can happen to this limit, or it's zero or it's positive. If it's zero, okay, that what does it mean that the H is zero? 3 more minutes. If H is zero means that when my domain got larger and larger, right, that is when the cubes got larger and larger, the measure of the contact set got smaller and smaller. Means the separation between the constrained solution and the free solution went to zero. Which means that the limit in free solution is above my polynomial. So the limit in free solution is almost surely sort of, there is not a limit in free solution, but sort of, the free solution in larger and larger cube is almost surely